Welcome to the Global Venturing Review podcast. My name's James Mawson, founder and editor-in-chief of our Global Corporate Venturing, Global University Venturing and Global Impact Venturing publications, and a great pleasure to be back once again with Thierry Hennis. Thierry, welcome.
Hello, Jim. How's it going today?
Not too bad. It almost feels like it's the weekend. We record this obviously on a Friday and release it on a Monday. So feels like we're gonna settle back to a couple of days of eating my body weight. That's the key plan.
Yeah, that's a good plan, Jim. That's a good plan. I might copy that, steal it.
Well, imitation is the most sincerest form of flattery, as you know, Thierry. So I'd feel deeply honoured if you did so. I'd feel like we'd be mutually sharing munching on a bicky in our respective places. So, but more importantly, what's been the exciting news of the past week? What have been the big deals that's caught your eye?
We have some very big deals this week, not even all in the big ones section. Starting with Klarna, which is the operator of an app that lets consumers pay for items from some 200 retailers through installments. And it's raised $650 million in a round that almost doubled its valuation to $10.65 billion in the space of just over a year. Klarna's earlier investors include Bestseller Group, Visa and Group, and Commonwealth Bank of Australia. And media group Bonnier is one of several investors that acquired shares in the company through a concurrent secondary investment deal.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty mind-boggling, isn't it? If you think around what sometimes used to be called interest-free loans, you know, you buy a sofa or something like that, and they'd say pay off the chair over 3 years rather than up front. And, you know, everyone goes, right, that seems a reasonable way to do it. But the fact that this is a sort of an online app that basically does exactly the same type of thing, you kind of get the good and then pay it back over a bit of time. Probably not even interest-free, probably have to pay some charges and fees as well through it. You know, and the fact that this could be worth, you know, effectively $11 billion having doubled in a year is just, it's just one of those things that kind of, you kind of go, well, seems to make sense. It's a good idea, but really? I mean, so congratulations to Klarna for being able to do it. I think it's a Swedish company that had operations in London. It's got a great group of investors, obviously, in Visa and to really understand the sort of payments-based Commonwealth CBA in Australia. And then Bonnier is a media group, obviously trying to think through how they can sort of replicate some of the payments success through what they've been doing, how they've been expanding. But it's an impressive round, impressive operation, but it's one of those sort of things that I'm sure a lot of existing payments companies are going, why couldn't that work by someone else? Why did it take a Swedish group to do it over the past few years to really make it fly? And I think they're going to run into competition from other payment groups. Obviously, Ant, you know, successful. There's Visa, there's MasterCard. You know, there's obviously PayPal and a whole host of others. But it feels like it's taken off in a way that, you know, is pretty impressive.
I mean, sometimes it does take the Swedes to kind of show the world how it's done. Like Spotify came out of Stockholm. And now we have everything from Apple Music to Deezer to Tidal. So maybe there's something in the water in Sweden. They get that stroke of genius and then the world goes and copies them.
Yeah, but it's very true. I think Skype back in the day had the first sort of voice over internet protocol. And I think if memory serves, sort of Niklas Enström and was Swedish, certainly from the Nordics. But
yeah, I think they were Scandinavian.
Cool. Okay, good. What else? But it definitely feels bubbly. There's a few reports in the FT and other papers on Friday and this week, which have been talking about, are we sort of reprising the sort of dot-com bubble, just given the sort of the 170% or whatever sort of increase in valuation over the past year for some of the big tech stocks. Just feels so frothy, you know, in terms of anything showing a bit of growth. You know, these are loss-making companies on the whole. Showing some good growth, but, you know, but still, it doesn't feel like there's a huge moat around any of these businesses that a different widget or a better sort of marketing wouldn't sort of retrieve. And then suddenly all these valuations just get wiped away. But, you know, maybe there is something, but it just feels frothy given the sort of the economic downturn in the vast majority of the world. So, you know, to have such massive valuation in increases, it's frothy. To be honest,
I mean, if you want big figures, I got some for those. It's a big year for tech IPOs, obviously, and there's actually several more multi-billion dollar news coming up in this episode. But one of the biggest upcoming offerings could reportedly take place in January next year, when short-form video app developer Kuaishou is reportedly planning to float in a $5 billion offering at a $50 billion valuation. Tencent owns about 20% of the company's shares, having invested $2 billion to lead a December 2019 round that valued it at $28.6 billion. It's going to be interesting to see whether its growth outside of China is affected positively or negatively by the ongoing US acquisition saga surrounding its biggest competitor, TikTok.
Yeah, TikTok's known as, I think, Douyin in China, from your notes there, Thierry. But Tencent obviously missed out on the TikTok parent, which was ByteDance. ByteDance acquired Music.ly a few years ago, and that became TikTok. And I think ByteDance was valued at close to $200 billion. So Tencent, I think, has definitely kicked itself over the past few years from having missed out on that. And obviously, it's been a big promoter and backer of Kuaishou as a result. And you know, if it could get a float away at that sort of valuation, then fantastic. Tencent actually was number one on the GCV power list this week. Jeffrey Lee, the managing partner, would be talking at the GCV Digital Forum on the 29th, as it happens. But you know, I think Kuaishou, as a result, is just one of about 100 plus unicorns or portfolio companies which are worth more than $1 billion. To put that into context, that's more unicorns than most venture units have as portfolio companies. So, yeah, it's just been a phenomenal decade of success and track record, not just by Tencent, but the number two, Alibaba, on the power list as well. It's just, you know, what they've achieved for China economically as well as development-wise. And, you know, and then obviously their international operations is hugely impressive. And I think it's going to create a bit of a tech lash for them. You know, there's a talk piece in the FT again about, in the Lex column, about whether, you know, sort of the US government will crack down on Tencent's primary revenue source, which is gaming and gaming companies, and owns about $20 billion of stakes in US gaming companies. So, you know, so I think that their success could reap sort of government feedback, not just in China, which banned the launch of new games for them for over a year, but increasingly in the US, which is an important market for them. So Kuaishou, or having these stakes in third parties which might be able to get away, or you know, then be able to create a funding cycle, is a smart thing to do, it seems like. And if they can get anything like the valuation that's been reputed for TikTok and hence ByteDance, then you know, I think that's that'd be super impressive.
I think I saw something just on the sidelines, and I didn't have time to dig into it before we recorded the podcast, but I saw something that the US now wants to ban WeChat as well from the 6th of October, I think it was, which, I mean, if they do that, that'll hammer Tencent, because I don't know if how the rules will work, because it might stop Apple from putting it on the phones in the first place, which will make iPhones worthless in China.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, so I think only 1% of WeChat users are in the US, and they're primarily Chinese diaspora connecting with their folks back home. So that won't be as significant as hit to Tencent as banning games or stopping the data sharing back to Tencent about who's using, what are they using. But the broader issue remains that in a sort of bipolar rather than a unipolar world, driven by the US, but with the US more concerned by China, then you start to see much more of a challenge around, you know, where do companies come from? What are the issues strategically from them? And how do they get whacked by, you know, tariffs and trade wars? We have been entering this issue the past few years. We've probably reached peak globalization back in the midpoint of the 2010s. You know, I mean, obviously we were writing a ton of articles at that point saying that, you know, from 2015 on, the golden age of corporate venturing had been reached. And that was partly the reason. It's going to be much harder to create the global business models and get business success stories when it's no longer a permissionless or frictionless globalized world, you know, which ultimately the Pax Americana have provided. So the fact that now sort of China's reached a step in economic size and a sort of geopolitical heft to start to push back, then it's going to create more tensions, but it's also going to limit the entrepreneurial opportunity. That's partly why I think it's so frothy for the tech valuations for Klarna. I mean, Klarna, the chances of Klarna breaking into China are frankly zero. The chances of Klarna sort of doing much in terms of the US are going to be tricky, given sort of the US sort of success and sort of advancedness. So that leaves the rest of the world, which is obviously the majority of people. But it's much harder to get people to pay or pay significantly in Africa, Southeast Asia, Latin America, even parts of the continental Europe. So I just think that these ideas that maybe 20 years ago people were having, say we can have a global market, think what Uber was trying to do, is just going to be too hard to do. And trying to get a valuation of something to be $10 billion, $100 billion, $1 trillion, $2 trillion, you know, it's I think it's going to be really hard. Yeah, there will be some that can do and create a model, but fundamentally, I just think the sort of dynamics for entrepreneurialism are challenging.
Something slightly different. Panasonic provided $100 million for the first fund to be launched by growth equity firm Conductive Ventures in April 2018, and it has now ploughed $150 million into a second vehicle that will carry on investing in sectors such as AI, digital health, and advanced manufacturing technology. The corporate is actually the only LP for Conductive, the owner of a portfolio that includes Proterra, Sprinklr, and Desktop Metal.
Yeah, congrats to Kerry Lai and the other team within Conductive for raising the second fund. Panasonic obviously had tried for a number of years to get its corporate venturing program really off the ground, and particularly with a US focus and team, but they seem to have found a good model and obviously a really successful sort of partnership there. So hats off to them and for making them work, and obviously great portfolio companies. Desktop Metal, I think, will have it's planned an IPO if memory serves. So I think it's been a real success story in that space. Proterra, obviously, likewise, around the sort of more advanced manufacturing and some of the issues around sort of advanced electronics. So yeah, it seems a good model. Definitely other corporations are using it and following it. If you can find the right team and back them and give them the commitment, then they can do the difficult job of finding good entrepreneurs. And as long as they got a close connection back to the parent corporation in terms of Panasonic, in this case, the funder, then it's a model that can really be very successful. Sapphire does something similar for SAP, and there's a whole host of others. So, definitely it's an interesting one and, great space to be in. So well done.
It's actually been a big week for crossover deals as well. We've had a few. The most notable, perhaps, was Lava Therapeutics, which is a Netherlands-based immuno-oncology therapy spin-out of Amsterdam University Medical Centers, or Amsterdam UMC, which secured $83 million in a Series C round on Thursday, co-led by Nova Ventures and Sanofi Ventures. And it also featured MRL Ventures Fund, which is a subsidiary of Merck & Co.'s Merck Research Laboratories. Lava is working on treatments for hematological and solid cancers and has allocated the capital to advancing its portfolio into proof-of-concept trials next year. The company builds on research by Hans van der Vliet at Amsterdam UMC, which is a hospital group affiliated both with University of Amsterdam and Vrije Universiteit Amsterdam.
Good crossover deal. I'll be interested in your perspective on this one, Thierry, from the university point of view. But obviously oncology is one of the big topic areas for the European Commission. Cancer is increasingly affecting as the populations age, just fundamentally as the climate gets a little bit harsher and diets for most people are a little bit crappier. You know, there are an increase in these types of cancers for general people. So finding solutions, being able to tackle it is one of the big challenges out there. And this is a big C round, obviously. Not quite as big as some of the really big US oncology treatments that are out there, but it's obviously enough to get them started with some phase one, it looks like, trials, if they're proof of concept. So if the trials work, then obviously they'll need to raise hundreds of millions of dollars more to continue it, or they'll end up being snapped up by one of the many corporates out there. So, yeah, good deal. What do you think from the university point of view, the UMC? Don't see that many spin-outs coming from the Netherlands, funny enough, but you know, I don't know why. They've got Eindhoven, which is a big technical university, some good other universities. What do you make of it, Thierry?
Yeah, I don't see too many from the Netherlands. They might be generating spin-outs, but they certainly aren't raising big cash from what I've seen. I mean, even Lava have been not secretive, but they haven't really advertised their funding rounds. This is a Series C, but the last one they disclosed, was in 2018, which is an $18.6 million round that they called their first major funding round. So probably a Series A. And before that, they'd raised $1 million in a seed round in 2017. So what happened to the B round? I don't know. They seem to be quite fairly quiet in the Netherlands. Obviously, these guys are doing great work. 83 million, as you say, it's not hundreds, but if the trials work, the D round is probably going to be quite significant. Unless Novo or Sanofi or Merck see something that they like and acquire it, and
Yeah, well, good ones. I think that's really insightful. Thanks, Thierry. And good deals. What about the more news and briefs? What's happening in the rest of the world of venture?
We still have quite a few nine and more figure deals. Starting with one of the biggest tech success stories during the pandemic, which has been Peloton's communal home fitness equipment and services. But Swift operates in a similar sphere, providing a social exercise platform that allows users to race each other on bikes or treadmills in front of a simulated CGI-based environment. And Swift has just pulled in $450 million from investors, including Amazon Alexa Fund and Zone 5 Ventures, which is not someone we hear about a lot, but it's a CVC vehicle for bicycle maker specialized bicycle components. Its earlier backers include Samjuli and Colourpol. And daily fantasy sports were a big magnet for VC cash 5 years or so ago, but the sector went quiet as companies found themselves having to deal with more and more regulatory hurdles. India's Dream 11 has, however, raised $225 million in primary and secondary financing, at a valuation reported by TechCrunch to be over $2.5 billion. Tencent had invested in the company in 2018, leading a $100 million Series D round that valued it at just $700 million. Indoor farming, meanwhile, may not have been the big growth area some people thought it might be this year, but there are still some sizable players in the market, and InFarm is one of them. It's raised $170 million in debt and equity financing from investors including Bonnier as part of a Series C round in which it is targeting $200 million. First Close pushed its overall funding past the $300 million mark, and it'll support the growth of its vertical farm network. And home fitness has, of course, been a big winner. Social exercise app developer Swift secured $450 million, as I just said. And Tonal, developer of a wall-mounted digital weight machine for home use, has pulled in $110 million from investors, including Amazon Alexa Fund and the CAA-backed Evolution Media. Its overall funding now stands at $200 million, and it is testing the potential of its technology in physical therapy through a partnership with Mayo Clinic. Funds, we've got a couple of new CVC funds. Japan-based real estate developer Mitsui Fudosan has partnered VC firm Global Brain to form a $81 million corporate venture vehicle dubbed 31 Ventures Global Innovation Fund 2. The fund, also just called CVC 2, will invest in startups developing real estate services or digitization and smart city technologies. The initiative will also seek out companies with innovative business models that can complement Mitsui Fudosan's core businesses. Tencent Trusted Doctors, meanwhile, the digital health subsidiary of internet group Tencent, has formed a $148 million healthcare industry fund with state-owned holding company China Resources. China Resources subsidiary CR Capital will manage the CR Tenkang Fund, which counts municipal funds Chengdu High Tech Investment Group, Chengdu Xinjiang Investment Group, and Chengdu Industry Investments Chengdu Advanced Manufacturing Investment subsidiary as partners. And Australia-based software development technology provider Atlassian has launched a corporate venture capital fund called Atlassian Ventures with $50 million in capital. Areas of interest for the fund include early-stage developers of enterprise collaboration applications that could be added to Atlassian's app marketplace, innovative cloud software providers, and established companies with products that could interact with its existing offering. Moving on to exits, as promised, some more multi-billion dollar deals for you here. Online real estate transaction portal Opendoor has opted for a reverse merger instead of an IPO, and is merging with a SPAC in a deal that will value it at $4.8 billion and net it $1 billion in financing from backers, including existing corporate investors Lennar and Access Industries. It had previously raised a total of almost $1.35 billion from investors including GV and SoftBank Vision Fund, and its last round valued it at $3.8 billion in March 2018. Snowflake has floated in one of the year's biggest IPOs and raised $3.36 billion after pricing its shares at $120 each, above a range that had already been increased from $75 to $85 per share. The data management software provider will also receive $500 million in a private placement, with half of that coming from existing investor Salesforce Ventures. Its exiting backers include Capital One Growth Ventures, which first invested at a valuation less than 5% of what the company's market cap will be. And actually, the growth of Snowflake, which floated at a market cap more than 15 times its valuation just 2 years ago, has been immense. Progress of another enterprise software provider, JFrog, which went public the same day in a $509 million IPO, has perhaps been understated as a result. But it has almost quadrupled its valuation in less than a year, posting a $5.75 billion market cap after its first day of trading. JFrog, developer of a software release platform, had raised $227 million from investors including Dell Technologies Capital. Mobile insurance platform Singapore Life has agreed to merge with Aviva's Singapore business to form a $2.3 billion company that will be called Aviva Singlife. Sumitomo paid $90 million for a 25% stake in Singlife in July last year and will retain a 20% stake in the merged business, suggesting it may have contributed to the $1.46 billion cash and marketable securities Singlife is paying Aviva as part of the deal. Insurance firm Aflac will also keep a stake, having supplied $20 million for Singlife 6 months earlier. And Amwell has floated in an upsized IPO that netted it $742 million in addition to $100 million applied by Google through a private placement. Telehealth software has been a big growth area over the past 6 months, of course. The success of Amwell, which counts Allianz, Philips, Teva and Takeda as investors, could perhaps be more closely related to a week where Snowflake, JFrog, Unity Software and SuperLogic all floated above their range to raise big money. It's a heady time for exits right now. And speaking of successful offerings, Outset Medical's shares have shot off like a rocket and sat at more than double their IPO price within 2 days. The kidney dialysis system provider has unsurprisingly closed the offering already at $278 million, up from an initial $242 million. Baxter Ventures, the corporate venturing arm of medical device maker Baxter International, is among the lucky investors. And C4 Therapeutics is developing small molecule drugs to treat cancer and neurodegenerative diseases, and it's filed for a $100 million initial public offering under 3 months after it received $170 million in debt and Series B equity financing. Its earlier backers include Novartis, Roche and Kraft Group, all of which contributed to a $73 million Series A round in 2016. And some comings and goings for you. Edward Klipos has departed from his position as a Spain-based investment director at M Ventures, the investment arm of German pharmaceutical company Merck Group. Amadeus Capital's partners has hired him as a partner, and he'll help lead its scale investment activities under the firm's managing partner Andrea Traverson. Daniel Broger, head of corporate development, strategy and mergers and acquisitions at Switzerland-listed industrial group Aurel Füssli, will leave next year to be replaced by Desiree Hoitschi, former CEO of consultancy Swiss Startup Factory. The company made its first corporate investment under Broger in March this year when it provided an undisclosed amount for Switzerland-based Procivis, developer of a digital identity verification product called EID+. McKesson Ventures, the strategic investment arm of pharmaceuticals distributor McKesson, has promoted Jennifer Carter and Kerry Hurwitz-Williams to partner positions in the unit. Carter had been McKesson's director of marketing communications before they joined the unit in 2015 as VP of portfolio development and marketing, helping to find synergy between the corporate and its portfolio companies. She added the role of VP of venture operations in September last year. Williams, meanwhile, had a 5-year stint at McKesson that ended when she moved to digital care provider Omada Health in 2014. She rose to VP of strategy and business development, before she was hired by McKesson Ventures again as principal in 2017. And finally, Daniel Sui has taken a new role with Virginia Tech as VP for Research and Innovation and will resign as University of Arkansas's Vice Chancellor within the same remit on November 1st. He'll be replaced at Arkansas by John English, who's been Dean of the institution's College of Engineering since 2013. An interim appointment yet to be announced is expected for English's current role. And that is it for this week's edition of the Global Venturing Review podcast. As always, you can leave us a review on Apple Podcast, SoundCloud. If this is your first episode, do hit that subscribe button. And if it isn't, don't forget to recommend us to your friends and colleagues. If you have any feedback, questions, you can email me at thelis@globaluniversityventuring.com. That's thelis@globaluniversityventuring.com. And you can reach Jim at jmawson@mawsonia.com. That's jmawson@mawsonia.com. With that, all that's left for us to do is wish you a productive week, and we will be back with you again next Monday. Goodbye.
Global Venturing Review was produced by In Ear Production. You can find out more by going to inearproduction.com.